When Doug Peacock went to Vietnam in the late 60s to serve as a Green Beret medic, he carried with him a small roadmap of Wyoming and Montana. He'd pull out the battered map to overcome homesickness and to recall his beloved mountains and canyons. Back from Vietnam, he found an antidote to his war experience in the wilderness. He was awed by his chance encounters with the grizzly bears. In his new book, Grizzly Years, In Search of the American Wilderness, Peacock writes, "The grizzly carried physical strength and thorniness of disposition that allowed him to attack or kill most any time he cared, but almost always he chose not to. That was power beyond a bully's swaggering." Since then, Peacock has spent years tracking the grizzlies. For a while, he filmed them. Peacock said he didn't go looking for the grizzlies. They found him.
I just happened to be out of sorts, like a lot of other vets, and I went and essentially lived in the wilderness because that's where I was comfortable. I went back in the Rocky Mountains and I sort of camped by myself, and I didn't really have a conversation with anybody outside of give me a beer or fill it up for, well over a year, year and a half. But one of those places I camped, there were grizzly bears around, and one thing that you do in grizzly country is you pay a lot of attention because you're living with one animal on this continent, which, if it chooses, can kill and eat you. And what it allows you to do is really get outside yourself, because self-indulgence is just impossible in grizzly country. And that's exactly what I needed. I really needed to somehow step outside of my life and look back on all of that, which had been my life in Vietnam for the past 2 years. And the grizzly is a very, it demands all your attention. And when you live in grizzly country, you walk with humility. You're really a second-rate citizen. And that attitude of humility, I find, is a very useful one, because it's really the emotional posture behind reason, you know, that receptiveness.
Is this attitude of humility one that you also felt when you were serving in Vietnam?
Well, that happens to be true. I'm not sure if the reasons are related. I was way out in the boonies in Vietnam, and my experience was a bit different from other GIs in the same era, mainly because I was never around any Americans. I worked on little Green Beret teams that were always understaffed, and there might be seven or eight of us on a team, but all day long, I would usually only spend maybe an hour with Americans. And when I went on combat patrols, there'd be normally two Americans, but occasionally I even went with just all by myself, and I would be the leader of a platoon of all mountaineers and Vietnamese. And I did this for well over a year, and you know, after a while it was kind of hard who I was and what I wanted to be. And so I had sort of an odd experience over there. I spoke Vietnamese, and I spoke enough mountaineer to hold a very primitive sick call, at least. But, you know, I would go maybe 6 weeks and hardly have a conversation in English. So that was a perspective that I just don't know anybody else that's lived it and written about it yet.
What do you carry when you go into the woods with you in search of grizzlies?
Well, I just take what I need to live on. You know, what you need to keep warm with, including a tent and a sleeping bag. You carry snowshoes if it's a spring, and a little bit of food. I don't carry much food because, like Jim Harrison, I'm a tad burly, and I can usually sort of metabolize for about 10 days without being in any trouble. But also when I'm out there, I try to live like a grizzly. You know, this time of year when the berries are ripe, I take a little bag of granola or sampa, but basically I eat huckleberries, you know, just like a grizzly bear. And just like a grizzly bear, you know, it's very healthy eating, you know, 5 quarts of berries a day. You end up, you know, with 2 giant piles of scat at the end of every day, whether you choose to or not.
You first went out in search of grizzlies in part to help purge yourself of some of the, I guess, nightmares of your time in Vietnam. Do you still have those nightmares?
I have them, but they're different. They've evolved a bit. I would say, incidentally, I have just as many dreams of bears as I do Vietnam, and my dreams of Vietnam are not terribly nightmares of combat. They're just as apt to be. Just dreams about the countryside, because Vietnam was a beautiful place, and I loved the highlands, I loved the people that lived there. And the same with bears, except grizzly bears in my dreams can be quite terrifying. And, you know, that's interesting, because when I'm out on the ground with grizzlies, I don't feel afraid. I think the fact that I haven't been chewed on or mauled or even touched by a grizzly bear and I've had, you know, several dozen close confrontations at 10 or 15 feet, probably, I think, I'm glad that I ridded the fear in my dreams rather than taking it out in the woods with me.
What was your most terrifying close encounter with a grizzly?
Well, I wouldn't say it was terrifying because something else, the terrifying just never happened, but there's one place that I'm going to go in about 5 days up in northern Montana where grizzlies gather in great numbers to eat huckleberries. There's no people there. Nobody ever goes in there to look except myself and a few people that have gone with me. But they form a social hierarchy, not unlike bears do at salmon streams. It's a little more subtle, but that's what it is. There's one big bear. It's a big, presumably male grizzly. I call him the black grizzly. When he comes in, all the other bears, even though they've been feeding on berries for weeks, they just begin to leave the range. Some years when he's cantankerous and really nasty, he virtually charges everything that moves, and that mainly means other grizzly bears. Well, one night I was on a ridge filming grizzlies, and a storm was blown in, a snowstorm, and there was a sow with a little cub grazing up the side of this steep ridge in thick brush, and below her, I saw this black grizzly come out and start to browse up the same hillside, and she hadn't seen him yet. And just as the sow reached the ridge in front of me, and this is a naked ridge, and it's only about 100 feet in front of me, this male grizzly that I call the black grizzly, the really the dominant creature of the social hierarchy, spotted her, let out a bellow, and charged flat out. And the female and her cub raced across the ridge right in front of me, and the black grizzly closed on the cub. And incidentally, the male grizzlies are the most dangerous thing outside of human beings to little bears. And just as the black grizzly was, his jaws were just inches below this little cub, the mother spun on her heels and met him with her jaws, and these two grizzlies went at it. You know, the female grizzly protected her young and the black grizzly that outweighed her by 200 or 300 pounds. And they slashed and bellowed. I'd never heard sounds like that in all nature. And this is all happening about, 70 feet in front of me on this naked ridge. And it's between me and the camp I've got to get to. And it's almost dark by then. And this fall blizzard is blowing in. And anyway, I thought the black grizzly was going to kill a sow. Well, she stood him off, and they stood nose to nose, bellowing at each other for seconds or possibly even a minute and a half. And then the sow sort of backed off, and the black grizzly turned its side, and bears do that when the fight is over. And then the black grizzly came back to the ridge maybe 50 feet in front of me, and it just stayed there and started to pretend to browse on huckleberries. That's called displacement behavior. But whatever it's called, it really didn't matter because I had, you know, there was nothing I could do. I had to face down this bear, and I had some bags in my hand. I sort of decided I was going to make a move on him, and I started talking to the grizzly, and he hadn't noticed me before then. And when I started walking towards him, about 50 feet away, maybe 45 feet away, he looked up at me and took a couple slow, stiff steps towards me. And I don't really remember actually what I said, but I think how you say it is much more important. And I had my head turned off to the side, and I talked to this bear, and this bear walked up perhaps 20, 25 feet from me, and its ears were back and its roach was up, and I just knew I was going to get it. And then suddenly, just as this charge would have taken 2 seconds, the black grizzly flicked his ears and turned his head off to the side and went down in the brush and disappeared maybe 20 feet away. And I raced by, got to the top of the hill, got my little camp, built a little fire, which I never do up there because I don't like to spook the bears. And it was dark by then. And within 25 minutes, I could hear this grizzly coming up the side of the hill. And I'd get some fire brands burning and go off to the side of the hill and say, "Hey, black grizzly, it's only me up here. Why don't you give me a break?" And the bear would come up within 20, 30 feet and then back off. And then an hour later, he'd come up another side of the ridge. And this went on until 2 in the morning. And by then, I found myself shaking uncontrollably like I hadn't done since I was strafed by the 101st Airborne in 1967 in Vietnam.
If most of your memories have been purged in part by going after the grizzlies, what keeps you going back? Is it the danger of encounters such as that?
Well, I couldn't deny that because I'm sure that's what attracted me to grizzlies in the first place, and it still does. It's that danger married to great beauty. I mean, grizzly is the most intelligent, the most human-like of all American beasts, and they're also dangerous, and I can't separate those elements. But as far as my experience in Vietnam, Vietnam sort of solidified my doubts. I was not a person that changed his mind about the war. I didn't think it was good, and I was just one of those person so perverse that I had to go see for myself. I have to do that no matter where I am and what I'm involved in. I have to check it out for myself. And so that's I did all that. But I think my instincts were right. And I've carried those all the way through. And one of those is that grizzly bears are really important. And in my sort of twisted way of looking at things, saving grizzly bears is a really radical idea because you just can't save grizzly bears without transforming the whole aspect of the American culture that put us in Vietnam. I mean, we just aren't going to be able to do that again. And what's going to say, what you learn from the grizzly is not just what is dangerous and what is dominant. What you learn from the grizzly are lessons of restraint. You know, being around grizzlies really teaches you a reverence for life more than anything else.
Doug Peacock, thank you very much for being a guest with us on Fresh Air.
Thanks. It's a pleasure.
Doug Peacock's new book, Grizzly Years, In Search of the American Wilderness, is published by Henry Holt and Company.